Welcome to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Welcome. My name is Larry Jacobs. I'm the director of the Center for Study of Politics and Governance here at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, the University of Minnesota. Before we begin, I want to encourage those of you who are joining us online to participate by clicking the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. Those of you joining us here in person will be passing out cards so you can give us your best questions. If you're online, you'll also see there's a transcript button. If you'd like to use that, please do. The center has got a lot of exciting programming coming up. Just going to quickly mention a few. On May 15th, we're continuing our Conservative Voices series that I've been doing with Vin Weber, and we're bringing in Stephen Hadley, who was the National Security Director for George W. Bush. And Mr. Hadley, Vin Weber, and I will be having a conversation. Please join us for that May 15th. On June 5th, James Homan, who's a columnist at the Washington Post, will be joining us. And we're going to be talking about the 2024 elections. We also have coming up as we move through the summer programs that include John Judas will be joining us, as I said, later in the summer. He's been a kind of a critic from the left of the Democratic Party. So we'll be getting into that. It'll be kind of just after the convention. So there'll be a lot of that in the air. I want to just take a moment and thank Cody Jacket, who's in the back. When you see us doing a program online or in person, Cody Jacket's doing the work. He's the guy who makes this happen, and we're very grateful for Cody to do it. Everyone who is a guest here always say to me afterwards, please thank Cody. He was so great. He made this happen. He made it easy. So, Cody, thank you very much. So let's turn to today's program. Women will be a major driving force in the fall's election for president and for Congress. What are the critical issues that are going to influence the vote of women? What are the dynamics at play in the election more generally? We're very fortunate today to have with us Anna Greenberg, who's a senior partner at GQR. It's a prominent 100% woman-owned consulting firm. One of the things that I really admire about Anna Greenberg is she's not only one of the country's leading political consultants, she's also someone who has studied polling and public opinion research. And I know that may strike some of you as odd to have someone who's doing consulting and polling and not actually know the research. Anna actually does. She went to the University of Chicago. She studied instrument design and survey methodology. She's a member of the major organizations that geeks like me use when we do research and public opinion, including the American National Election Studies, or ANES, for those who are in the inside. That is like the spot, and Anna's on the board of that. It just speaks volumes to her and her expertise and the quality of her insights. Moderating today's conversation is my colleague, Catherine Pearson, who is an associate professor in the political science department here at the University of Minnesota. Her research is wide-ranging and includes congressional elections and politics and women. So we have a great conversation coming, and I want to thank both Catherine Pearson, our moderator, and Anna Greenberg, our guest.
Great. Thank you, Larry. And thank you all for joining us here and online for today's program, The Power of Women Voters. We are joined by a terrific guest today, and I'm excited to get started. So there are so many questions that I could ask, and I encourage all of you in the audience to be writing down questions as well. And we've received some from online, but I really want to start by talking about the Dobbs decision. I think there'll be some follow-up there as well. But you, both with your polling and then your work with candidates and your background, have great insight into how the Dobbs decision affected the 2022 elections and how it is shaping the discussions of the 2024 elections as well. So can you start by talking about the impact on 2022 and then move to 2024?
Sure. And I just want to thank Larry for inviting me to come and do this. I think I worked with him here and Mr. Mondale like 20 years ago. So I think it's been 20 years since I've been here. So I'm very excited to be back. And thank you, Cody. And thank you, Kathleen. So I think that the Dobbs decision really was an earthquake in 2022. And, you know, it really transformed what happened in that election. I think that those of you who are political junkies, which I assume is mostly everybody who's online and in this room, you knows that in the midterm after presidential year, usually the party in power loses seats. Usually it's a lot of seats. And if you think about, if you remember the summer of 2022, inflation was very high. Gas prices were really high. You know, there was lots and lots of COVID backlash. The president's numbers were pretty, they still are, pretty challenging. And there was a sense that it was going to be a red wave, that Democrats were going to lose everything in 2022. And I think that, now, first of all, I don't think that was totally true. So we can talk about that. I think there's assumptions there were some real problems with it. But leaving that aside, Dobbs really upended that in a pretty profound way. And there were hints of it. You could see. So, for example, there was a very interesting study after the Dobbs decision. There was a pretty big shift in voter registration. And you saw this real bump in younger women registering to vote, while younger men's voter registration kind of stayed static. It didn't, persevere throughout the entire election cycle, but there was a good couple months after Dobbs where you saw this bump in registration. You also saw, it's kind of similar to when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, a big bump in donations and a bump for women candidates. And so you kind of saw the energy, right, that was kind of in reaction to this decision, the kind of energy that was sort of fueling really strong Democratic strong Democratic women candidates, but strong Democratic, making these Democratic campaigns even stronger. And then you also saw there had already been kind of a shift. This is why I think it wasn't all Dobbs. There had already been a shift post 2016 and 2018 of college educated women and suburban women in the Democratic Party. And they hadn't really shifted back. So you didn't see as much of an impact there because we already had this movement. But there was a real gender gap opened up among independent voters. And so independent men and women, who are by definition not partisan because they're independents, there's actually an enormous gender gap among independents. And choice, that issue, and women's issues more broadly absolutely drives that gender gap. And you saw a real shift among independent voters. So again, there was kind of this registration impact, campaign donation impact, kind of energy with Democrats, and then a kind of shift among independent voters moving away from Republicans because of the issue. So it was pretty profound, but I think that there was not a lot of updating of the models and the thinking about what was going to happen in 2022, and a sort of sense of disbelief that this particular decision could kind of upend our traditional assumptions about what happens in midterm elections. And there was a lot of resistance to it, and there was a lot of putting a thumb on the scale and polling towards the Republicans. And so you had this like red wave of polls towards the end that all were wrong. And we can talk about that if you want to, but there was this disbelief that abortion could have the impact that it did, which in part I think reflects the male bias of political consulting and the media and that sort of thing. And I think that women consultants and others had a very different idea of what might actually happen in response to the Dobbs decision.
And so how do you see that playing out in 2024?
Well, I think it will continue to be the defining issue that it has been. And I think that there are some people who think about it as a policy issue that people have opinions on, and that is probably true for some people, especially men. and male voters. It's not true for women. It's not even, I call it existential, but it's not even existential because it's actually real and happening in real time, especially in red states. You know, you think about, you know, the woman in Texas and, you know, who the Supreme Court says you can't have an abortion and she has to go to another state. And you think about, you know, what's happening in Idaho, and you think about in Ohio prosecuting a woman with a miscarriage. So it's all happening, you know, in real time, all the problems that women are facing, you know, because of it. But I think there's this kind of tendency to look at it like it's a policy issue that people have opinion on, as opposed to like a real challenge to what I thought the world looked like and my place in the world, which is what I think women voters, how they've reacted to it. And so I think you have, it's not gotten any better. This is 2022. It's only gotten worse. And then you're starting to see with the IVF, you know, decision, whatever the Supreme Court, it feels like on the abortion pill, they'll actually vote against, you know, sort of it seems like the court will say that you can't ban the pills, but certainly on the Idaho decision around emergency care, it looks like it's going to go sort of the wrong way on that. And so these Republicans in these state legislatures cannot help themselves kind of falling over themselves to be more and more extreme. And so I think it is going to be as important an issue as it has been, as it was in 2022. And certainly the Biden campaign has made that clear. And every campaign I work on, you know, it is the number one issue for people who are going to vote Democratic. So I think it's going to be just as big.
And that is very helpful perspective, but it seems as though some perhaps older white male Democratic consultants don't see it that way. You wrote a very compelling op-ed in The Hill recently, making the case that some prominent Democratic men, such as James Carville, underestimate its effect by talking about preachy females. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. So you may have now seen that Maureen Dowd did a column on James Carville, and as part of it, he sort of attacked the Democratic Party as being dominated by preachy females and having too feminine of a message, and that we need to talk about hamburgers, football, and beer. And obviously, I know James well, and some of that's for effect. He, you know, he does that, and he gets a lot of attention when he does it. And I thought about ignoring it, but I was I called it rage writing. I was pretty angry about it. And not just because I think he was wrong. I mean, just wrong in terms of the actual data, what public opinion research and, you know, and what the work I do in campaigns kind of shows you about the power of the issue. So I just think and the issues that affect women, he's just wrong. But also I think there are so many young women who are running campaigns, who are working, you know, are just killing themselves, you know, to try to win these elections, and to have a luminary like that say, you know, you're all sort of, you know, preachy and, you know, we need to get back to talking to men, I thought was just a really kind of demotivating and sort of thing to say to all the women by the way, I only work for Democrats. So just, I don't know, that wasn't made clear in the introduction. I'm a Democratic political consultant. So when I say we, that's what you may all be Republicans or not partisan, but that's what I'm talking about. I know this is a nonpartisan institution where we're speaking. And so I just felt like this is like, what a terrible thing to say to all the young women who are working in Democratic politics today. But the piece was very much focused on the data, right? And so, you know, if you go back, you know, really, if you remember in 2010, you know, there was sort of the war on women election. It was the post-Tea Party. It was the Tea Party election, the backlash to Obama. And, you know, people were very much focused on the Tea Party being about taxes and small government, but it was a very, very racist and misogynistic movement as well. And if you remember, you know, Aiken, who in the McCaskill race talked about legitimate rape. You can't get pregnant if, you know, it's a legitimate rape. And there was Richard Murdoch, I think, said, you know, if you just kind of close your legs, you know, put an aspirin between your legs. Somebody said that this year too, by the way. I can't remember who it was, but somebody said that this year. And you had, you know, 2010 just and the years of all ushered in, you know, thousands of anti-choice bills across state legislatures. And so the kind of movement on abortion and the Republican Party kind of movement there starts, you know, before Dobbs, and sort of builds over time. And I think that's one thing that people like James Carville and others misunderstand, is this has been building. This has just happened out of nowhere. This has been building and building and building. And Democrats have, you know, for reasons that made sense at the time, and I can understand, and I was part of, we tried to talk about it, but you would go do focus groups and surveys, and it was very low salience issue. So people were pro-choice, but the issue was not motivating, you know, many, many people who are, you know, I was born in 68, so I never remember a time when abortion was, you know, illegal. And so there are a lot of voters who it's not even their consciousness that this is something that would be illegal. And so, you know, you'd maybe talk about it in a Democratic primary. Or you would send direct mail to college-educated women in the suburbs. But it would be all the abortion messaging would be targeted messaging, right? It wouldn't be like broad messaging. You wouldn't, you know, advertise broadly on, you know, on broadcast news or on the issue. And so, you know, again, so the buildup. And then you have Donald Trump, who's like, you know, the most misogynistic president, you know, I think we've ever had, both in the way he talks about women and, you know, the way he treats them and sort of the role they play in the administration. I mean, he couldn't be a more misogynistic. And so you kind of layer all this, you get to Dobbs and it's like, it's kind of like the, it's explodes, but it's all built on something. And so that's kind of what my piece was about. And so the idea that for women, this is just a thing that happened that I have an opinion about kind of ignores that the kind of encroachment on women's rights and women's right to self-determination is something that's built over time and women understand it. And so, you know, I remember my father was doing focus groups with Trump voters in Michigan, kind of in Macomb County, you know, after Trump, you know, after, in, you know, in, after Trump was elected and after Dobbs. And these the non-evangelical Trump women were outraged about the Dobbs decision, right? And so you have a bunch of Republican women, not just the kind of moderate that you think of country club Republican women, but actually, you know, non-evangelical blue-collar Republican women incredibly upset about this decision. And so I think, again, going back to James's sort of comments, it just is a profound misunderstanding of how women in this country feel about rights being taken away.
And just to follow up briefly, you, of course, mentioned non-evangelical Republican women. What about evangelical Republican women? Are they now stronger supporters of Trump, or does do his more recent comments complicate that?
I mean, I think that the story of evangelicals and Trump is kind of, it's pretty, I mean, people like Tim Alberta and others have done some really interesting writing about it, but it is the strongest constituency for Donald Trump. And I don't think there's much that Donald Trump could do to shake that constituency, you know, loose. And I think that there's a lot of excuse making for Trump. I've heard, you know, the Susan B. Anthony folks and that sort of thing just talk about the sort of, you know, the main thing is he got Roe v. Wade, you know, overturned. I don't think you're going to see any. And I think that the, you know, part of the power of Republicans trying to win elections on the back of transgender people and stuff is about solidifying that evangelical group. It's not a particularly high salience issue for regular voters, honestly. And in fact, I mean, if you look at the Kentucky governor's race, you know, last year, they ran about 7 anti-trans ads against Andy Beshear, did nothing. So, but I think that the leaning into that issue helps with the evangelical base. So I think that is just solid. I don't see any erosion.
Well, Democrats are very concerned that young voters aren't adequately supportive of Biden and may stay home in November. What are you seeing and what are your thoughts on this?
I have very unclear feelings about it because I think that there are lots of things happening at the same time with younger voters. And so on the one hand, they are the most progressive voters in the electorate. Absolutely the most progressive. They're also some of the least partisan in that they're less likely to register with a party. And so, and there in some senses a pride of not being part of a party. So you have their highly, I mean, at least up until, let's just take this time period and put it aside from what up and through 2020 and 2022, you know, among the most, you know, reliable Democratic voters because they're very progressive. And I think that in this whole conversation about weakness with young voters, people are losing that thread about how progressive younger voters are. And I think the challenge for establishment politics with younger people is rooted in the economic experience of younger people, which is this recovery has not benefited younger people nearly as much as has benefited older people. And so whether it is, you know, and inflation affects hourly wage workers differently than salaried workers, right? And so even though inflation's gotten better, job market strong, it is still the case that the housing market is impossible for people who are younger. And so I think there's an economic struggle for that younger people face, and they don't necessarily see that Biden has done some great job with the recovery the way the national economic indicators would suggest. And it's different than there's a partisan interpretation of the economy. So if you ask Democrats, they say it's doing better, Republicans worse. But in fact, the people who really are doing worse are younger people. So I think the weakness there is about just a profound sense that this country doesn't know how to help us and take care of us. It doesn't matter whether it's Trump or Biden, like we're screwed, you know? And so I think that there's an overblown kind of, sort of concern about Israel and Gaza and how that affects younger people. It's a very small number of younger people for whom that is like the most important issue. And a lot of them are people who actually hate Biden and hated him before October 7th. And so to me, the concern about younger people is less about Israel and Gaza and more about disconnection, because you think that nobody actually can do anything for you or care about you. And so that's, to me, the challenge for Biden. And that's where student, you know, that's where like college debt and other kind of bad debt and those kinds of things become really, you know, really important, I think.
So what advice would you give to a hypothetical client, Democratic client, about mobilizing young voters in 2024?
I think we don't have great answers for young people. That's why I've had very very coherent. I mean, I think we have to deal with the housing market, but that is not like a campaign slogan. You know what I mean? But I think that that is, you know, that is, I think, the biggest problem for people who are younger is that they can't actually afford to live. But I think remembering also kind of progressive values and that sort of thing, and not getting distracted. I'm not in any way dismissing the importance of the Israel Gaza issue, but like, let's not get distracted as that is the reason that there might be a problem, because I think it leads to weird solutions, you know, that aren't necessarily meeting people where they are.
And also talking about jobs with younger voters. And what about voters of color? I feel like there have been some headlines recently about polls that Biden is also losing support among voters of color, and there's a gender divide there as well. How do you interpret that?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's pretty clear that, well, first of all, it's very hard to talk about voters of color as a group, because there's, and you know this, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but there's big differences, right? And so I think that the group where we've seen the most erosion, if you will, for Democrats is among Hispanic voters. And that's a very complicated story to tell, because in some cases it is about country of origin. And so, you know, in Florida, Cuban and Venezuelan voters are very different than, say, you know, people in New Mexico who are of Hispanic origin, who've been in New Mexico for 500 years, right? So it's, and speak English and don't speak Spanish, right? So like, to talk about the Hispanic vote as a whole is super complicated. And there's differences within the Hispanic community and the growth in certain populations that aren't necessarily Democratic. You also have the same problem around the economy. There are many Hispanic communities, including in Nevada, who've not yet, still haven't recovered from the 08 recession, right? And so inflation and housing and those sorts of things have a different impact on the Hispanic community than other communities. I think that the erosion there is real, but it's geographically specific. And it's so like, and haven't seen much evidence in Arizona or Colorado. And there's a big gender gap. And Hispanic women are very Democratic, and Hispanic men are less so. But I was listening to Simon Rosenberg on a podcast actually yesterday, who was talking about, was something I hadn't thought about, with the growth of the population in terms of raw votes among Hispanic voters. Democrats have been getting more votes than ever. So you also have to kind of think about, there's change over time, and then there's raw votes, right? So I think that that's a different, then if you look at AAPI voters, this is a group of voters that also is diverse and growing and is actually very Democratic. And it has a lot, I think a lot of it has to do with the Asian hate, Kung flu stuff that Trump has done. And so I think that there's, and also the better educated you are, the more likely you are to be Democratic. So there's also education levels and income levels. So there's a lot of reasons. So that's actually a pretty solidly Democratic group, and the gender gap there is smaller. And then among, you know, Black voters, Black women still, you know, are the bulwark of the Democratic Party. Super, you know, very, very, you know, 80-90% depending, and you see more erosion with Black men. So I think it's like a really complicated story. And, you know, I think that it's, you know, a lot of the public opinion polls don't have enough sample size among voters of color. So they'll put them all into one category of 150 people, or they'll have very small sample sizes. And it's really, really hard to measure the complexity and the difference and just talk about all Hispanic voters as one block. So I think that I'm not suggesting there aren't challenges, but I also think it's much more complicated than the public polling kind of makes it out to be.
Well, if you look at white women voters, as you well know, white women voters as a group have not supported a Democratic presidential campaign since 1996. Do you see anything different in 2024 post-ops?
Well, no, not necessarily, but I think that white women have moved more Democratic since Trump because white college educated women have moved much more. So white Mitt Romney won white college educated women. That's how recently the majority of white college educated women voted Republican. Now about 60% of white college women vote Democratic and have since 18 and have not gone back. Right. So overall, white women have gotten more Democratic because of the shift of white college women, you know, into the Democratic Party. So I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head from 2020 on what happened with white women, but I think it was closer than it has been in the past. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Okay. So what about Stormy Daniels?
I'm not a lawyer and I'm no expert on all this stuff, but I've always thought that that case from a public opinion perspective, you know, people, oh, we have to have January 6th first. We have to have the documents case. This case is going to look like a puny little, you know, sort of, you know, New York kind of aggravation, and it's going to seem like a distraction. And I've sort of disagreed with that. I feel like one of the things that a lot of women don't like about Trump is that he's a misogynist, that he's vulgar, that he mistreats women. And you've got the E. Jean Carroll case, obviously, was, you know, pretty prominently in the news. And then you have another, you know, kind of case that is sort of his dark underbelly, you know, his vulgarity. And so I think reminding women of that is always helpful. There's other reasons why I think it's an important case, because they're really making it an election interference case, not a illegal payoff case. But I think anything that reminds people, reminds women of that kind of aspect of his character is helpful. So, I'm very pleased this case is happening.
Sort of no matter what the verdict.
Yeah. No matter what the verdict. 'Cause I just think reminding everybody that he's just a reprehensible person, I think, is always helpful.
Sort of turning in a different direction. Obviously, polling is critically important to what you do and to political scientists and understanding the election. And with an increase in public polling, you know, voters are looking for polls as well. But there were some real problems in 2016, 2020, 2022. Can you sort of diagnose some of these problems, tell us where we are now, and then compare private and public polling?
That could be like a whole other hour or more, because the sort of problems with the polls have been overblown, I believe, and they've been different from cycle to cycle. And not only that, there's a whole other set of issues around polling that have to do with the, you know, the increase in people doing online surveys, the decrease of phone surveys that sort of from a methodological perspective are kind of disconnected from the problems of public polling, if that makes sense, that there are inconsistencies among the public polls because of methodology, and that get very complicated. So it's a whole story is very complicated, but I'll try to shorthand it as much as I can. In 2016, the poll, you know, as you know, Trump was elected president, and because everybody assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win, then part of the narrative was that the polls were all wrong. Now, actually, she won the popular vote, and her average lead in the national polls was about 3 points, which is about what she won it by. So the national polls were actually, in that sense, not wrong. That being said, you know, he did win. And what you could see at the state level, at Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and places like that, that, you know, Donald Trump found a lot of new voters, people who were like eligible to vote, you know, but hadn't voted. He found a lot of new non-college educated voters. And the issue is that polls are biased in the sense that people who are better educated are more likely to take them. And so the polls had too many college educated voters in them and not enough non-college. And Trump did incredibly well with non-college. And so his vote share was underestimated. And so the fix after that was we have to have more non-college voters. And actually in 2018, the polls, you know, no one thought they did great. Problem solved. And then in 2020, the polls were wrong again. And again, the national polls were not wrong, but Biden was leading in the national polls, but the state polls were. And, you know, what happened there was fixing education level didn't fix them. And so, and there was a bunch of post-election, including APOR and Roper, and then individual pollsters who did all this analysis to try to figure out, and they could never figure out why they were wrong. And so I think part of why they were wrong was that Trump found a million new voters. And, you know, when you do a poll, you have to have a sampling frame. You have to figure out who you're going to talk to. And if you were eligible to vote in 16 and didn't vote, we would have never put you in our poll in the first place. You weren't a likely voter. So I don't know that that's the core of the problem, but I think it was part of it is that if you weren't making sure you had those, there was no way to know all these people were going to vote who hadn't voted before. So at any rate, every year you try to solve for the last problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so in 2022, it felt like there were multiple, there were 16 and 20 where it seemed like we were not able to measure the Republican vote. And so a lot of the most of the polls were what I sort of were overweighted. You know, I called them in the New York Times cover your ass polling. Like, let's make these really Republican and then we won't be wrong when the Republicans win, or even if they don't win, it doesn't matter because we'll all be so happy Democrats won. It doesn't matter if they were wrong. And that's kind of what happened. Like, a lot of the polls were wrong in 22, and no one in my world talked about it because we won a lot of stuff.
Right.
It was very interesting. And so a lot of the polls, I am not going to be, when I was talking to Larry, a cross-tab truther, as Nate Cohen attacked people who look at his polls, called them. But a lot of the polls have that same bias. Doesn't mean they're going to be wrong. It's just we should be clear that the polls look very similar to 2022. And so I do think that the media polls and the pundits always want to sort of put the thumb on the scale for Republicans a little bit because they get attacked more by Republicans for Democratic bias. And so that they can't be seen, if a survey seems to come in too Republican, they can't weight it to make it more Democratic because they'll be attacked for it. So I think that that's part of what's going on.
So to follow up based on a question from the audience who is likes your optimism, must be a Democrat, but is concerned about the most recent polls that, you know, show Trump with an 8-9 point margin. So how do you...
Well, there aren't polls with an 8-9 point margin. I mean, the average right now, as of last week, was like a 0.8 margin for Trump, the average. So you can't look at any one in one poll. You got to kind of have to look at the average of all of the polls. And I think there are some more concerning ones at the state level, which matter. The national polls don't matter. It's really what's happening at the state level. I think it is way too early to get freaked out. We don't know anything. I mean, first of all, the polls have been moving more towards Biden really since the State of the Union. And I just believe that Trump is diminished, running not a great campaign. He's not able to campaign because he's in court. So I think we just all need to calm down. And we don't know anything about the third party stuff, you know, which, you know, now people think RFK is hurting Trump more. We don't know what ballots he's going to be on. It just feels like there are so many things that are not settled. And we've never, ever, ever had a presidential election where one of them was on trial. So like anything we know about the past does not necessarily apply here. So I think it's just really premature to get. And the other thing I would say is that I think I like to look at non-polling sources of information. And so you've got Democrats have basically not lost since 16 and have overperformed in every special election, including this year and last year, have won every abortion initiative, whether it was beating a bad one or winning a good one. You know, in 2020, three, we won Kentucky governor. We won back this House of Delegates in Maryland. We picked up seats in the Jersey legislature. And so New York 3, Swazi won by 8 points. So winning is helpful. Like that's where the winning is happening. There is a massive fundraising difference, not just between Biden and Trump, but also below that level. And Republicans are having to rely really, really heavily on super PACs and corporate donations. And there's a whole reason why having your own donors is better than having to rely on outside money. And then you've got party infrastructure differences. You know, there are certain states like Arizona and Michigan where the Republican Party is just broke and a disaster. And so these are the groups that help deal with early vote and door knocking. And so there's just infrastructure differences, you know, between the parties that are really profound. So I'm not dismissing the polls. They're very close. It's going to be very tough. You know, there's going to be states that make me very nervous, like Nevada makes me very nervous. You know, Georgia makes me very nervous. So I'm not in any way downplaying how hard this is going to be. But I think polling is not the only source of information about what's going to happen in this election.
And you sort of predicted my next question, which is what states will you be looking at? And will they be the typical states that we always look to? Or are there any new state swing states on your list?
I mean, I think for presidentially, it'll be all the same states, but I think North Carolina is one to, I mean, this is conventional wisdom, but North Carolina, Biden barely lost it. Mm-hmm. We have a very, very, MAGA, crazy Republican candidate for governor, which if you go to 2022, in states where turnout met 2018 or 2020, they were states that had MAGA candidates like Blake Masters, Doug Mastriano, Herschel Walker, had these really, really crazy candidates that really engaged Democratic turnout. So, you've got that in North Carolina and a state that, again, that Biden barely lost. So that one feels on the map. And then Nevada, I just is always very worrying. And so that one continues to be worrying. And I think that one, but I think that all the rest are the ones you'd predict: Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, all the states that you'd expect to be close. And I think Georgia is concerning because we don't have big Senate races there. It's just the presidential. So, there's definitely, I think that, by the way, Biden doesn't have to win all those states again to win the Electoral College, to be clear. I would like him to win all those again and easily win the Electoral College. But he doesn't actually have to win them all. He can lose a couple of them and still win. So.
Thank you. What is your take on the importance of the vice presidential candidate generally and in 2024 in particular? And how do you think that will sway Trump's decision of who he picks?
I mean, I think I don't think it matters very much in general, because this is about this election. A lot of this election is going to be about Trump, right? And so typically, an incumbent running for re-election would be about Biden's performance. I think we can all agree that his performance objectively is okay. I think many people could agree is good, right? In terms of the economy, for example. And, there's objective measures about how the country's doing, our economy relative to other economies in the world, So I think that, that he's doing a good job of managing the country, so to speak. And I just don't think that's what this election is going to be about. And I think he would like it to be about that. Biden would is not going to be. And obviously, they're very polarized and partisan views about that. I think ultimately, this is going to be about like what kind of country we want to be and whether or not we want to be a democracy. And I think that's why this election is going to be about Trump. And so I just don't think whether he picks Kristi Noem, who kills dogs, or picks, J.D. Vance really matters all that much. Because at the end of the day, this election really is going to be about democracy. And I mean, abortion and women's rights are completely intertwined to the conversation about democracy. Those aren't separate issues. But I think that that's what this election is going to be about. And that's really about Trump.
So in thinking about what this election is about, in this media environment, in this polarized era, how do candidates reach voters these days? Through the thick of social media and partisan polarization, how have strategies changed?
I mean, it's a really different environment than when I first started doing this. I mean, on the one hand, some of this is just how we've always done things. So campaigns are going to run ads on broadcast TV. The electorate's much older than the country as a whole. So there are still lots of people who watch broadcast TV. There'll be ads on cable. There'll be, the Essence New TV, which is, OTT. So ads, on Hulu and on Prime and on Roku and all these streaming services. If you want to read an article in a newspaper website, sometimes you have to watch an ad. So you'll have those kinds of things. So you'll see kind of typical advertising. It's just shifting a little bit online, but it's not fundamentally different, right? It's just a different vehicle to deliver the same stuff. And you will still see direct mail pieces and you'll still do door knocks. So campaigns are going to do all of that. But obviously we're doing it in this very siloed and fractured media environment. And I think that the number of people who we would consider kind of persuadable voters is pretty small. And it's generally low information voters. It's not necessarily, there are very few people who don't have opinions about things who come to the election year like, oh, tell me what's happening. What should I do? It's more that people don't pay attention. They engage late, and they, and so those voters who tend to be more likely to be women, more likely to not have a college education, more likely to be independent. Those tend to be the kind of the persuadable voters. And they're the people that, again, kind of engage late. They are very pro-choice. You know, and that's another reason why I feel optimistic about this election, because this is a group of voters who are pretty clear about on that issue.
So I know the answer will be both. But when it comes to a campaign dividing its resources between mobilizing partisans who might be less likely to vote and persuading these sort of independent, low information, you know, sometimes voters, where should a campaign focus?
Well, I think, yeah, it is both. But I think that in a high turnout context, which we've been in historically high turnout since 2018, a lot of what's happening is turnout focused, right? And less persuasion focused. And the composition of the electorate, you know, is not the same each election year because people die and people register to vote and different people get mobilized. And so if you look at 2020, there was a very different group of people who got mobilized to vote. They were conservative people, but they got mobilized to vote. And so I think with the exception of college educated women who have shifted their voting behavior and it's stayed that way, there are very few groups that have shifted, and it's much more about composition of the electorate. Now, there is an element of persuasion in persuading people to vote. So that's why it is sort of like a weird, it's become kind of almost a, it's not really a distinction that makes much of a difference anymore. Right. So if you were to say to a sort of an Hispanic voter who feels, you know, struggling economically, who doesn't feel like listened to, but generally speaking, would be more likely to vote Democratic than Republican, you actually have to persuade that person that it makes sense to come out and vote and something could come of it.
That it matters.
Right. And so I think it's not a distinction that makes sense anymore. And maybe it'll change. Maybe after Trump leaves the scene, we'll go back to lower turnout elections. But in this very high turnout context for this country, it's very much about who you're mobilizing to vote.
Who you're mobilizing. For many years, but certainly since 2018, women candidates have made a difference for the Democratic Party. So we saw a surge of women candidates in 2018, and that has continued, though at a slower pace since then. Republicans are trying to catch up. What does women's candidate emergence look like in 2024, and what difference have all the new women candidates made?
Well, I think in 2018, it really was, I mean, people talk about 1992 as the year of the woman, but I think 2018 was the year of the woman, because I think it starts with the Women's March, which was the biggest single day demonstration in American history. If you, you know, all the city and also in the world, I mean, there were people marching in London and right in Paris. And I don't know that people have really processed that that was the biggest demonstration in the history of our country. Single day, obviously. And there were many people who out of that decided to, I mean, Lizzie Fletcher and Kim Schreier, who are in Congress, are my clients. They decided to run after the Women's March. Like there were people who decided to run after Congress and get involved after. And you saw a flood, I mean, not just running for office, but, you know, revitalized local parties. Because then the Democratic Party really thinned out post-Obama. You know, Obama didn't really invest in the party. He kept it very separate from his stuff. And there was a lot of draining of resources from local party organizations, and women reinvigorated local party organizations. So it wasn't just running for Congress or running for that. It was kind of at all levels, kind of reinvigorating the party. And so women donors. And so women really drove those victories in 2018. And I remember working in primaries, and if you had a woman candidate, she would have like a 10-point advantage just because she was a woman, which never happened before. People always assumed women voted for women, but as you know from academic research, it was pretty clear that gender really is not a determinant of vote choice. And so it was in these primaries. And actually, I remember like men getting mad, like, Emily Sliss is coming in, and they're getting all these women and this unfair advantage. And it's like, well, you can go create your men's pack to help elect the men in these primaries if you want to. And so that I haven't seen it happen again, right? The bigger issue in terms of women is the shift of women voters of college, you know, of women voters to the Democratic Party. And part of it is there aren't that many competitive districts.
Right.
There aren't that many open seats. There were, what happened in 18 was women were running against these long-term Republican incumbents. So like when Lizzie beat, you know, Culberson, he'd been the congressman since 1992 and had been a backbencher, done nothing. And everyone just assumed, oh, this Houston's Republican, he's going to get reelected. And he, you know, got beat badly. And so a lot of women won these kind of seats that hadn't quite, it's kind of like when the South realigned in 94 and all these Democrats kind of finally lost in the South to Republicans. It's the same kind of all these suburban districts realigned to where they should have been. And we haven't had those kind of opportunities since then. There haven't been open seats or, you know, there's just not as much there. So it's still the case that women are incredibly strong. They're very strong in primaries. They don't have the same built-in advantage that they had in 18, but 18 really was the year of the woman.
Right. Thank you. And so thinking more generally about House and Senate elections in 2024, what dynamics do you see at play for Democrats in House elections, the possibility of retaking the majority, and then the possibility of maintaining or not the Senate majority?
I mean, I think that the conventional wisdom is that Democrats, you know, will or can win back the House. And I think that's, I won't say will, because I'll never, after 2016, none of us make predictions anymore. But I think obviously there's a really good chance. And some of it is that, you know, there are some seats that Democrats barely lost in 2022, and there was no investment in those races. So I'm working in a few of those races where Democrats lost by, you know, 1,000 votes or 2,000 votes. Actually, I have three races I'm working in where we barely lost, and nobody spent any money in those races, meaning like we got outspent 6-1 or 10-1 or that sort of thing. So I think that those are prime flips. You also have a couple new seats in Alabama and Louisiana, new Democratic seats, some new lines in New York, which haven't dramatically transformed it, but have actually increased the chances of picking up a seat. Already picked up one in flipping George Santos's seat, but maybe picking up another seat in New York. And so I think that what it doesn't say to me is like wave 30, 40 seat pickup, because honestly, because of gerrymandering and polarization, it's really hard to have those kinds of dramatic, you know, changes in the House. And we'll probably need another redistricting year potentially to get to that. So it could be a very small majority. However, I was saying last night to you that Jeffries seems to have a lot of the same skills as Nancy Pelosi in terms of keeping the Democratic caucus together in the House. And so, you know, it is possible if Democrats were to keep the Senate, that you'd be able to have more kind of legislation passed the way it did with a very small majority in the first 2 years of the Biden administration, because I think Democrats can stay together in a way that Republicans can't. And you certainly have seen that in the discipline around, you know, the speaker's vote and the rule vote, you know, and letting the foreign aid bills go. I think the Senate, again, this is conventionalism, much harder. But I think that we got a gift in Ohio with Moreno as a kind of MAGA crazy candidate against Brown. And I think if anyone can win in Montana, it's John Tester. And that if he's actually, you know, polling is decent there. So I don't think it's a given that Democrats are going to lose the Senate. I think Gallego will win. So I think it's going to be hard, but I don't think it's a given that Democrats lose. And I do think that I really do think this kind of what is the future of our country going to be and the future of our democracy is the driving force that I think it's going to be. I think we could potentially overperform in 2024. Even if it's very close.
A questioner asks, what do you think politicians like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Kristi Noem, Carrie Lake, I'll add Lauren Boebert, do they put off Republican women voters or do they mobilize women voters?
Republican women. I don't know. That's a good question. Actually, one of the things that Republicans did in 22 was elect a lot of women mm-hmm. who are not those voters. Like, you know, there are actually a bunch who aren't like that. That's a really good question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, I think there are just as many, if not more, crazy Republicans in the House as there are Republican women, but they really are special. I mean, it's not just there's Luna in Florida. I mean, there's a bunch of you know, Nancy Mace. I mean, there's a bunch. I don't know. I don't think they probably do turn off Republican women who are, I mean, if you look at the Republican Party, it's about 70% very, very conservative MAGA and about 30% kind of moderate and not. And so I assume for that 30%, which is maybe more female than male, they are not attractive, you know, Republicans. But I think for the 70% of kind of the Trump base, I think it's just fine. And also keep in mind that, you know, people are living in information silos. So we may see someone a certain way and they may see them differently because of what they're experiencing and the media they're experiencing it's very, very different. And so, you know, that's part of the challenge as a political consultant these days is that I used to feel like I knew kind of what everyone was hearing and seeing, and I don't know that now. And, you know, sometimes you do focus groups and people say things and you're like, where does that come from? And you realize there's a whole set of conversations going on that we're not privy to. And so I just think that's why I say I don't know, because I don't live in those worlds. I don't inhabit them. And so it is something, and it's not, I'm not proud. I'm not saying that's a great thing that I don't know, but I just don't, you know, and I suspect that, you know, most of them are pretty popular with their base.
Yeah. And I mean, it speaks to how fractured the media environment is. And it also speaks to the fact that when I first started studying women in politics, you know, there was this notion that women were the bipartisan ones working together. But, you know, the women who were successful seemed to be actually very partisan.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I know. I mean, we talked about this earlier. I don't know where that comes from, that women are more bipartisan than men are.
maybe the Senate,
so,
you know,
yeah, maybe the Senate. Yeah. I mean, certainly there was this group of women senators, mm-hmm. you know, who would be together socially too, not just, you know, work, you know, in, and so that there were Republican women, you know, sort of spending time with Democratic women and vice versa and friends. And that was, you know, wasn't it Susan Collins and someone else who broke the impasse around the debt ceiling? Can't remember when that was. That was, feels like a million zillion years ago. But I don't think it's, yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily, it's mostly people who are running in competitive races need to do bipartisan stuff so they can say that in their ads.
We have a questioner who is following up on our conversation about vice presidential candidates with two octogenarians at the top of the ticket. Don't voters care more about vice presidential candidates?
I don't think so. certainly Nikki Haley wanted to make the argument that if you were voting for Biden, you were voting for Harris, right? There are certainly people trying to make that argument around Biden that you're really good. He's going to, you know, something's going to happen to him in a second term and you're going to get Harris as president. It doesn't seem to have a lot of traction. And I think, you know, it's so immaterial to Trump voters. I mean, Trump does not translate his power to other people. If he could, all the people he endorsed in 2022 would have won, and they all basically lost, right? So I think it's just somewhat irrelevant to Trump voters who the VP candidate is. I think this election is about something much bigger than any of that.
This is my own question following up. Do you see any controversy at either party's conventions?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there's already plans in the work to try to have 1968 like protests in Chicago. And I don't know. I wasn't, I was born that year, so I didn't experience it. So maybe some other folks can weigh in. Wasn't partly the power of that is it wasn't expected or wasn't right. Like I assume it's going to get planned for and there's going to be like barriers all around and you're going to be like, there's going to be a parking lot where people get to protest. I don't know. It feels hard to, I think the issue will be, so anyway, that's what I've heard is that's sort of what people, but I don't know if there'll be any controversies. I doubt it at the Republican convention.
And then we have a couple questions about sort of the future, you know, both with the combination of how young people are doing and are they really worse off than young people in previous generations? And then what will politics look like 20 years from now with more disaffected younger voters who are less partisan and less attached?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an economist, so I don't know with, you know, facts that younger people are worse off now than they were at any other period. I mean, I would think that young people in the Depression were pretty bad off. I mean, so we always have to figure out what our historical perspective is. It does feel to me that the combination of real wages not increasing over the last 30 years and the expense of a college education and the decline of manufacturing and the rise of the information economy, you know, all seem to have conspired to make it much harder for young people who don't have a college education to succeed economically. And so plus the kind of more short-term things like inflation, you know, and so, but like housing to me is a long-term problem. It's been created over the long term, the housing problem that we have. And so it does feel like for and that's just not an insignificant number of people. Majority of people don't go to college in this country, right? It does feel different, but you know, I'm not an economist, so I don't know.
So with sort of lower affection for either party, even as more identify as liberals and progressives, what does this mean for politics in 20 years? You know, are young people running for office? Or are they getting involved in the system?
I mean, I think that the Democratic Party is much better positioned to be a party of the future and a future of young people, both structurally because of what's happened to the Republican Party. It's become a minority party, a mostly white party, and sort of anti-immigrant party. And so I think that that makes it hard that they have to reinvent. There has to be an implosion and a reinvention of the Republican Party. And I don't see that necessarily happening in the near term. And I think the Democratic Party is better positioned. And there is, even though we have, you know, Biden as the president, there are a lot of young governors and members of Congress. There are a lot of young people in the party. And the Democratic Party feels better positioned in the future to kind of meet the very diverse needs and issues that face younger people in this country.
One questioner asks, what can people who have not been very involved in politics do to get involved in 2024?
Oh, there's so many things you can do. I mean, I do think being involved in party politics versus movement politics is more effective to make electoral change. So getting involved in your local party, you know, is where the actual party work happens, whether it's the get out the vote or the, you know, stuff that is driven by local party politics. It's where future people who run learn about politics and make their connections to other people, because so much of it is about relationships. So if you're young, and you know, that to me feels like the thing to do. Obviously you have resources. Giving money to candidates, even small donations, actually matters a lot. Our party has a lot more small dollar donors than the Republican Party does, which is why we can run better, you know, campaigns. So there's just unlimited possibilities to do at the local level and with giving money. But I think that I'm not being critical of grassroots and organizing and kind of left movement politics. It's just not as effective in the electoral sphere if you want to do something right now for 2024. You know what I mean? It might be good for long-term narrative change or long-term policy change and kind of moving a party in a particular direction. But if you really want to like help, and I would say that, you know, I don't think this is going to be a very competitive state presidentially or at Senate level. So if you have the ability to go to a different state to do something, you know, do that, because, you know, it's actually been challenging to get, it's actually been very challenging in this full economy, this full employment economy. It's actually been hard to hire people. And so campaigns are fairly desperate for field workers and things like that. So finding a competitive congressional or Senate race or gubernatorial race, or even the presidential, there is massive opportunity to get jobs doing that, because it's been very difficult to hire people.
Thank you. So we have a number of questions about Minnesota. And so I'm interested in the Washington sort of perspective, the national perspective on Minnesota. And that is, you know, is Minnesota a swing state? You sort of answered that. No, we will have, I guarantee you, an article in the newspaper soon. You know, Minnesota, Hillary Clinton only won by a percentage point and a half in 2016. Trump came to visit, is Minnesota a swing state? Sort of what difference are our senators making? And then, of course, what is Governor Waltz's future?
People want Minnesota to be a swing state, so people pay attention to it and resources, but, you know, Biden won it pretty easily. You have sort of complete Democratic, sort of governance in this state at the legislative and gubernatorial level, but also in your federal delegation. And I just don't think it's going to be a terribly competitive place in 2024. I don't know what Tim Walz's future is. What does he want to do? I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't work for him, so I don't know.
We don't know, but every so often when he makes national appearances, people ask the question. So
I mean, there's going to be, no matter what happens in 2024, the race for the 28 nomination will start the day after the election. Right. And I'm sure that every governor in this state will be on the list of people who might run. in this country, every governor in this country will be on the list of people who might run.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful, wonderful conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. We leave. A video recording of this program will be available 1 to 2 days after at the link you see on the screen. This program will also be available in podcast form on all of your favorite podcast platforms and can be found by searching Dialogue Across Difference. We recommend subscribing to our podcast so you don't miss any of our event recordings. Thanks to our joining us today, and please another hand for Anna Greenberg for a great conversation.
Thank you.